Investment Management Operations is brought to you by Intelligo. Intelligo is the premier due diligence platform delivering innovative pre-investment background checks and continuous subject monitoring for some of the most sophisticated asset allocators. Their individual and company background check reports blend the critical discernment of human experts with cutting-edge AI, ensuring you receive the most thorough and rapid insights. Groups like Common Fund, Adam Street Partners, Felicitas Global Partners, and past capital allocators guests Hamilton Lane, AIM13, and NEPC leverage Intelligo to mitigate risk and enhance their operational due diligence process. Visit intelligo.ai to learn more. Hello, I'm Ted Seides, and this is Investment Management Operations. This show explores the inner workings of the most sophisticated institutions in the industry. Through conversations with executives across operations, compliance, legal, and finance, you'll hear how key operating partners run their businesses in an ever-changing and complex investment landscape. You can join our mailing list and access Capital Allocators content at capitalallocators.com.
I'm Scott McDonald, and I'm your host. My guest on today's show is Terry Thompson. Terry is the Chief Operating Officer of Berkshire Partners, a Boston-based private equity firm that started in the mid-1980s before adding public equity capabilities in 2007. My conversation with Terry did not disappoint. He shares how his background across eight different industries helped him land the role at Berkshire. We talk about how to quickly transition into a new industry, how to assess a career opportunity with limited information, and how to build rapport with long-tenure team members. We then cover Berkshire's unique governance structure that focuses on stewardship, communication, and transparency that uses a team of teams approach. We turn to his thoughts on industry trends with regulations, fundraising, and what people are doing right now with AI. We joke that we need to look back a year from now on our AI predictions, but I'm making a note in the calendar. Please enjoy my conversation with Terry Thompson. Terry, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You're with Berkshire Partners. I'd love to hear how you found your way there.
It's been a varied career. So I've had eight different jobs in eight different industries. Started out with some of the classic preparatory kinds of things with public accounting at Coopers and Lybrand, strategy consulting at BCG. And then I left BCG to join a client, Delta Airlines. Went from Delta Mirant in the energy industry. They were in a restructuring mode and then went to Mercer, took a CFO role there on the HR consulting side and eventually became COO there. Then did a quick private equity portfolio company turnaround at a company called DF King for Riverside. And then just before Berkshire Partners, I was at Ropes and Gray, where I played the CFO and COO roles. And one of Ropes and Gray's clients was Berkshire Partners, so I gained a little bit of familiarity with the firm. So I chose Ropes largely on the basis of their culture, just a super high integrity organization, great people, a very excellent work, but also a similarly high level of integrity. And that was a reputation Berkshire had on the private equity side as a client of Ropes. So when the opportunity came, it was intriguing enough. And the more people I met, the more I talked to them, you could just see that not only was it an exceptional group of people, but the values were a leading item in all of those conversations, which is really important to me.
And how did you hear about the role at Berkshire?
I actually got a call from a recruiter, and I will never forget it because the recruiter's first words were, "Don't hang up this time." I was not in the market, not looking, but she felt that I would find the industry interesting. You know, as someone who likes getting on a learning curve, it's a fascinating industry and a fascinating set of different business activities. But she said that the culture and the fit are just really good. They're the kind of people you're going to want to work with. And so I took the call, and the more people I met, there just wasn't anybody you didn't respect and like right away.
Was the COO role new at the time?
They had gone through a few iterations of it, and they had a couple of people playing it in different ways. I think what they were looking for when they were recruiting was looking for someone with some outside experience. I think private equity as an industry is now getting to the point where you have lifers and lots of people who've been in the industry for a long time. And I think there was some attraction of bringing outside thinking, particularly as the firm was starting to grow and move past the point where you could get everybody in a room on Monday morning and you had to think a little bit differently about a growing organization. And so some of those larger organizations I have been associated with, I think, allowed me to bring some things to bear from other industries.
Given your diverse background, was that a culmination of all the things you did with a singular focus, or was it something else?
It's interesting. For me, I've had this trajectory into smaller organizations. They've all been great organizations, but the Delta Airlines was 100,000 people, Mercer was 20, Ropes and Gray was 2,000, and now we're about 200 people. And so I think, I don't know if it was a culmination, but I think some of the pattern recognition and some of seeing a little bit further down the road of what a larger organization with more complex needs is going to have to do has put me in a position where I can bring something from that perspective. And there's a lot of pattern recognition. People are people. All those businesses are people businesses at the end of the day. But for a small investment firm, a lot of those growing pains are not completely dissimilar from the growing pains other industries have gone through.
Could you talk a little bit about the dynamics of a law firm versus a PE firm? Because my take on the law firm is you have a lot of people who are solely focused on working on their clients and not thinking about the bigger picture, and then also trying to make the leap over into private equity where you're all trying to lock arms.
One of the things that was similar between Ropes and Gray and Berkshire Partners was they're both very much premised on winning together as a team. So Ropes's whole philosophy was you put your best foot forward and you bring your partners and you don't have your own individual book. We're all working together and that creates some need for governance and direction. And you need to do certain things to make a partnership with that mentality work. But that was actually pretty similar coming over to Berkshire Partners, where from the start, it's been set up as a team-oriented, stewardship-oriented model, where everybody's, as you said, locking arms. So that cultural difference wasn't as big. I think one of the differences, and something I've really enjoyed, is both of them are very fast-paced industries, but in law, it's responsiveness. It's, if an email sits for more than an hour, you start to get antsy. There's a similarity in private equity, but to change the direction of the ship in a law firm with hundreds of partners around the world takes a long time. It's just not as nimble a craft. And a firm our size, we can make a decision and be implementing it intraday. So the culture may be the same, but the ability to make a decision and go is at a completely different speed.
When you arrived at Berkshire, how much time did you sit back and take in the information before trying to deploy big plans and ideas for some change?
Having gone through a number of these learning curves in different industries, you have to go into it with a pretty good sense that you know what you don't know. And even now, 3.5 years in, there are parts of this industry that are so specific and so important, you know, the details of an LPA or the minutiae of fund accounting, that you really need to be careful not to overestimate your ability to understand or to begin parlaying that into strategic thinking or advice. A lot of that advice has to be grounded in that detail. So it's a little bit different from some industries where you can stay at 30,000 feet and be pretty effective. At the same time, I think there's a lot of the patterns of behavior in organizations, which I find really interesting. Why do people behave the way they do in organizations? You can bring something to bear on that side pretty quickly. And so a lot of the early observations I was able to make were around how we govern ourselves or how we interact and communicate, which are a little more universal. It was moving fast on some things and being appropriately slow on others.
And how long did it take for you to get up to speed on all the mechanics around Berkshire's operations?
The usual learning curve is the first year, you have to be really guarded. And after the second year, you're starting to get your bearings. And by the third year, you've got it. I think with some of that complexity and with the regulatory oversight and demands, we have a fantastic finance team and a great compliance team. And the compliance team's brought in at a very early stage. They're very much ingrained in the operation. So you always have that safety net. But I think the basics of what drives the economics and what drives the success of the firm and the culture were all pretty quick. But I think the business at a high level was relatively quick. It doesn't make it easy. It's just easily understood, but not easy to execute. The detail, it's still something I'm very cautious about.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you build rapport. A lot of people come into this industry, if you come in a senior role through the side door, later stage, a lot of people take that title for granted, but there's also this element of how you work with people. I'd love your thoughts on how to make that the most successful transition.
one of the things that the firm really leads with is its values. And one of those is the power of teams and teamwork. And it shows up in a lot of different ways, but there's a desire to hear different views that is very genuine, and it's built into the business model. Being able to have a voice at the table didn't require being credentialed. It just requires having a good idea and putting it out there. And so when you're in an environment where people want to hear different viewpoints and perspectives, it's a lot easier to do that. I think probably the most common phrase I've said in my career is something along the lines of, this may be a dumb question, and I don't know what my batting average is on dumb questions, how many are actually dumb versus not, but it was not hard to have a seat at the table, either positionally or just because of that intellectual curiosity that permeates the firm. That was a lot easier than I thought it might be, coming from outside a very well-established industry with its own language and norms and operations.
We're culture first, but there's not always a match. How did you know that Berkshire was the place for you?
One of the signals actually about how much they care about culture was it's a lengthy process. We probably had 24 or more conversations before I joined, which right away tells you they're not just hiring for the resume or the experience base. They're trying to find a certain type of person. For me, the teamwork comes through in the way it's organized and the way people talk about it and the ethos, the way it's set up. So I was pretty confident on the teamwork side of things. Another one of the values is that relationships matter. And joining an organization in COVID, how am I going to build relationships? People were like, look, we'll put in the time. It's going to take longer than normal because we're all at home, but here's where we're going to go. So I think the teamwork and the relationships were pretty easy to parse. I think the one thing you never know till you get there is the integrity. The way we put it is winning the right way. But usually in positions, CFO, COO positions, you're going to get an opportunity pretty early on to see the firm hit a gray area and how they handle it. The integrity is just off the charts. I've been in a lot of great organizations, but the mutual belief that we're going to do things the right way, and that when there's a gray area, we put more light on it and figure it out and talk it through and do the right thing. Just, it's so ingrained in the culture that within a couple of weeks, I could see that I was in a place I was going to really enjoy being. At the end of the day, if you don't trust that the people you're working with are going to do the right thing, it's dicey. And that just wasn't ever going to be an issue here.
I'd love to take a step back and get an overview of Berkshire. Love your thoughts on that.
We're coming up on the 40th anniversary here in the next couple of years. It's 100% employee owned. We've got about $25 billion in assets under management, split about 80% private equity and 20% on the public equity side. Boston based, founded in 1986. We have a long-term view on investing, which translates into a long-term view on the firm. And so the stewardship model has been baked in, and the average MD tenure is about 20 years at this point. So there's a lot of history, a lot of organizational memory. We have two businesses under the same roof. We have that private equity business, which is where it started. And then in about 2007, we launched Stockbridge, which is a concentrated, long-only PE style public equity business. Now we've grown to about 200 employees, but I think we still have, in a good way, a lot of that small firm DNA. It affects how we make decisions, how we communicate, things like that. And from the start, it always had that team orientation. There's no name on the door other than Berkshire Partners. It's nobody's name. There's no corner offices. There's no CEO. So it's always been a partnership in a very true sense. It's always really valued that teamwork element.
Could you just give an overview of what your areas of responsibility are?
I've got finance, HR, IT, marketing and communications, and facilities and operations. So a lot of the classic COO functions. And as with many of these roles, that comes with a lot of being at the crossroads of operational items and making sure the right people are connecting and the inbox is filling up every moment with something, keeping the organization moving forward. The somewhat unique or different aspect of my role is supporting the executive committees that run the firm in a direct way. There's three main committees. There's one overarching firm-wide committee, and then each of private equity and public equity have their own executive committees. So those three committees have been delegated authority by the partnership to make decisions and to guide the firm. And for each of those, I spend a fair bit of time helping, ranging everything from making sure it's all administratively taken care of on the back end and that they're focused on issues and substance and not on administration. But there's a lot of facilitation and working with the chairs of the committees to think about what are the topics coming down the pike? How do we want to structure this? How do we set up processes? Like many firms of our type, time is the most valuable commodity. And for committees to run efficiently takes a fair bit of work in the background.
What's the biggest thing that slows people down on running a bunch of committees to get everybody pointing in the right direction?
I think you can spend as much time as you want trying to organize the perfect agenda, the perfect sequencing, all these things, the right process that's intellectually pure. And we are very much committed to constant self-improvement. So we're constantly thinking about, hey, next year when we run this process, how should we do it differently, and logging in and expecting really good execution. The hardest part is always the prioritization and making sure we're focusing on the right issues, the right things, and that's where the time and the effort is going to. The committees were formed in large part in response. As the firm got bigger, you couldn't have all of the partners in on every decision. And I think a lot of firms have gone through that experience. You could spend a lot of time focusing on little things and feeling like you're making progress, but our job is to put capital to work, and that's always got to be the highest priority. A lot of my time is spent helping figure out how to get that balance right.
I would think that that level of transparency is complicated. You want to give enough information to keep people informed, but not so much information to bog people down.
We spend a lot of time, both in written and other forms of communication, making sure the pith is coming through. And in a lot of cases, the thought process. I think that's one of the differences. It's not just, here's a decision, but it's a lot of the context, and it's a lot of listening too. We are believers in teamwork. And so getting other viewpoints into the thought process is a big part of the decision process, and making sure we're listening and hearing from all the different perspectives before a decision gets made. So there's a lot of two-way communication involved in making that all work and keeping the trust in the process high. But yeah, you try to make it as pithy as possible. And I occasionally will even sneak in a bit of a sarcastic joke or something like that, just to make sure people are still tuning in. But there's a huge appetite for information. And I've never met a group of people that is such voracious readers. So there's a lot of it being consumed in real time as it's happening.
Based on your background working with different firms, how hard is it to get people to focus on the objective versus going down the rabbit hole?
Everyone knows what the highest objectives are and what our commitment to our investors is and what we're trying to do. I think we have such talented people and so much capacity that we can make everything better all the time by focusing on it. And so I think the constant challenge is how much time is going to investing, how much time is going to the existing portfolio, and how much time is going to the day-to-day running of the firm. And when you have that kind of talented group of people who could make everything better, and the more voices that are heard on what we're doing, how we're stocking the refrigerator, I'm sure there's a better way to do it, but that's not the highest calling. And everyone understands that. I think when you're allocating those resources, you have to keep coming back to those North Stars though, because our job is to put money to work and put it to work well. And there's a lot of different things you can do to make that happen. So we're constantly challenging ourselves to make sure we're lined up and focused on the right things. And some of that you get through process, some of that you get through just continually reinforcing what the priorities are. We spend a lot of time talking about what the priorities and goals for the year are collectively as a group, and then just reminding ourselves and revisiting that through the year too.
Let's say I have a longtime founder in PE and I'm thinking about that transition. How do you make that handoff?
I think the first thing you got to do is go get a time machine and get those founders to set the firm up for that in the first place. We were lucky that beginning group had a lot of foresight and built the stewardship into the model right from the start. Those initial five had different strengths and they all brought those to bear. You handle the finances, I'll handle people issues, I'll handle the governance of a divide and conquer servant leadership mentality built in from the start. But even in the way the firm thinks about ownership, it's owned 100% by the active partners that was set up from the start. The fact that we have these committees that are now stepping up has been really helpful as well, because that serves as both a good way to govern in the spirit of partnership without having too much of it skewed to any one individual. You're getting lots of views there, but it also allows for people to sort of apprentice with the committees and move forward. The committees can be linked from generation to generation. Even the compensation model has always been set up on a stewardship basis. So some of the pitfalls I think a lot of firms have in trying to navigate through governance and compensation were off the table from the start. They were built into the model. I do think that the thing everybody can really focus on is that transparency. I think having been in a lot of different partnerships and different sizes, the more the partnership understands what's going on and why and how decisions are being made, the better. That creates that trust that there is going to be a generationally thoughtful approach to transitions and to the long term.
Love to turn to industry trends. What is Berkshire thinking about today based on the landscape?
From my perspective, one of the trends is just the increasing complexity. So I've only been in the industry for 3.5 years. And even in that period of time, the complexity, the pace is high. That's always been the case. But the complexity that's coming at us in a lot of different ways, the diversity of the LP base, the rise of all these different vehicles, the more creative approaches to how to deploy capital and return capital to investors, that complexity, I think, is putting a lot of pressure on firms to figure out how to manage it. There's firms that have grown to the public company status and are more institutionalized. But for a lot of partnerships that came out of a relatively small base that are now growing into larger firms, that rise in complexity is putting pressure on organizations that in a lot of cases had one or two person teams dealing with these issues. And now you have the volume of work, the complexity of work, the number of entities you're dealing with, the number of audits you have to do, all of these things are going up. And so you have to start institutionalizing things, and you can't rely on individual contributors and outside vendors. At the same time, you don't want empire building and a lot of unnecessary infrastructure. That's going to be a challenge. How do you maintain that responsiveness, that flexibility, that efficiency when in any given year you could have 10 new entities that need to be audited? And so I think there's going to be a lot of work amongst the peer group to choose how to institutionalize those things, what to insource, what to outsource, when to use a vendor, when to build a team, when to rely on systems and process, and when to rely on one really good hub person that can make sure it's all getting done, but keep the organization light. I think that's one trend worth keeping an eye on. I think there's some things we can learn from the larger institutions, but I think as an industry, because the firms tend to be relatively small, I think it's a little bit underserved by some of the vendors around us. There's not a tremendous number of options on a lot of the different systems that are out there. When you look at outsourcing, in a lot of cases, it's not outsourcing to someone who's got a better model. They're just lifting and shifting and taking your problem and putting on their books for a price. So I think for an industry that moves as much capital as we do and has such an access to resources, there are some elements of the operations that are not being fully addressed by the marketplace. So I think there's some opportunities there. In some industries I've been in, that's been solved by sharing resources. And the airlines, they built the GDS systems because they had a shared need there. The complexity is not going away. On the private equity side, some of these entities will live for decades. When you add complexity, you're adding it for the long haul. The other thing in terms of trends we're watching and spending time thinking about and acting on, artificial intelligence is on everyone's mind. I think we entered 2023 without that on our priority list, which in retrospect seems amazing how much it's really come into focus even over the last 18 months. So we mobilized last year to really get our arms around it in terms of how do we prepare our portfolio of companies for this? How do we think about what we invest in going forward, but also how do we think about it for internal operational use? In my career, the only other thing I can think of that had such an obvious need to be addressed, but with a lack of clarity on how it was going to play out, was the rise of e-commerce and the internet. Everybody's talking about AI, but if you say, where are we going to be in 5 years? Everybody has a different answer. It's not clear. So the approach we've taken has been to engage, to be really on the out there, understanding what's happening in the marketplace, but to also just start doing stuff. So we've spent a fair bit of time and a little bit of resource, not a ton, building things and learning and seeing what's working for us and talking to our portfolio and making sure they're thinking about it and learning from them. So there's been a very active dialogue internally on that. And we've got a great team that's working on it that has people from the portfolio support side and private equity. It's got people from the IT organization who can think about how to institutionalize things and some data scientists who are all working together to build out something for us to learn from. That'll be interesting to track as things go forward too, because I think some of the lower hanging fruit, things around efficiency and how do you ingest information, you know, this industry is constantly looking for more and better and faster information. So there's a lot of what AI is being used for now is to take that and synthesize it. How do you generate things? That still remains to be seen. I think one of the challenges for artificial intelligence for us and for the industry is it's good at the general and not at the specific. And investing is often the devil's in the details. Precision levels are high. So there's a lot of reconciling to be done there.
A couple of related thoughts on this. With this focus on AI, how do you think this is going to impact hiring for groups like Berkshire?
It's a good question. I think some of it's relatively straightforward. I think data science and having people who can translate between business and technology is going to be really important. And we've got some great people who can do that. I think the interesting thing for me as an observer of this is how differently individuals are adapting to it. So we've got an on-premises, an LLM, large language model that we're using internally. And what's really fascinating is if you look at who's using it, some people are using it 40 or 50 times a day and pushing all kinds of tasks through and have figured out how to use it as a tool. And these are people who are very time constrained. They're not doing it because they're curious. They're doing it because it makes their job easier and better and more efficient. We've got other people who are barely using it all. So I think one of the things we're going to have to be conscious of on the hiring side is how fast are people able to adapt to this new tool. Even within our own organization, I said before, we have a team that includes our IT folks, the portfolio facing people, and data science. The fourth member of that team is the marketing and communications group, because this is really going to be a change management operation. Getting people to build habits around this, you can have a great tool, but if no one's using it or they don't know how to use it well, it's not going to get used. People aren't going to use it because they're told to use it. They're going to use it because it works. And so figuring out how to get something that works and then how to get that deployed in a way where it becomes part of the day-to-day routine is the first challenge we're really looking at.
Is that something you might kick up to a committee to help define and set the stage, or is it a more of a bottom-up approach?
Up to this point, we have been thinking about it at all the different levels. I think at a practical level, it's been pretty bottom-up so far. We've talked to people about where are your pain points, where could AI possibly change what you do, how you do it. And that's where we found this commonality around synthesizing information. There's variety within that too. There's different types of information that has to be synthesized to different levels of precision. So there's a lot of working through how to customize the tool so that it's giving people something they could use. I think eventually that will run its course. There will be a point where that reaches some plateau, at least a lower trajectory of change around that. Once we get past that and get some of the low-hanging fruit gathered, it's really unclear. And that's one of the reasons why we're building some things and we're testing things to learn, but we're not building them in a way that we're tied to them permanently. It may be a year from now when we talk about this again, we may have gone to a completely outsourced SaaS model because someone's figured out how to take portfolio company data and synthesize it in a way that works. Or they may have figured out how to write the deck you bring to a prospect in a way that's so much better than we could do on our own. That's the part I haven't gotten my head around yet. I think that's where our committees and our partners are going to have to help think that through, is what is our ambition? Are we fast followers, making sure we're enhancing the business? Are there aspects of this where we need to invest our own time and capital to build something? So far, we haven't hit a point where we have to make a major decision on that yet because of that low-hanging fruit, but it's coming. It's probably coming faster than we think. That's where the back and forth with the portfolio has been really helpful. The various needs in the portfolio and the need to stay smart on that, we're in constant contact with dozens and dozens of people who are trying to apply this in ways that work in various different industries, including private equity and public security investing, but also in consumer and services, industrials, technology, communications. So we're getting a lot of good information about what's happening out there at the cutting edge. What's really interesting is that I don't think anyone has forward visibility in any of those areas out more than about 12 months of where this is going to go.
The number of people coming to market with expertise here is now bubbling up to the surface. How do you know who's really good?
Like I said before, this is a very precise industry. When you're making an investment, it may be the 50th detail you check that tells you whether it's a good investment or a bad investment. So what we've been doing on a lot of these applications, especially when we're digesting information, is back testing. So where we've already gone through and we've summarized 50 expert interviews, we know what we concluded using our own time and human judgment. We can run that through and see what the model's kicking out. And we, in one case, tested, I think, a dozen or more SaaS providers to see how close they could get. And then we compared it to what we could do on our own with a little bit of customization. And it showed that, at least in that instance, at this moment in time, having some customization, knowing how to break the data down in the background, we found that building our own tool was better at this moment. But it was a rigorous process. And that back testing, I think, is the easiest way to get there. The amount of resources and time that's spent digesting information in the industry is so high. We're going to have opportunities to see how well the tools work. What was really interesting is a lot of them weren't very good at all. We hear about AI hallucinating and things like that. There are plenty of instances where an otherwise good tool with a great pitch deck would come back with something that was, if not incomprehensible, just flat out wrong, getting facts wrong and not being able to trace it. So I think another thing that's really important for us, at least, is knowing why it's coming back with the information is and having a bit of an audit trail. Knowing why it's telling you this is the synthesized result and being able to follow those annotations back has been a game changer for some of these applications.
Have you had any response from your LPs about what are you thinking about this or diligence, anything going on there that's interesting?
The fact that we're looking at it at all three levels, what's it going to mean for the portfolio? What does it mean for future investments? And what does it mean for us internally has resonated. Our high degree of sensing of the environment has been well received. I think that's been something people appreciate. And I think the thoughtfulness and the transparency of here's what we know, here's what we're learning, and here's what we don't know yet. And I think that's a hallmark anyway of the way we interact with our investors. The clarity of thought and the acknowledgement and the humility to know that we don't have all the answers has been well received.
So does that mean that there's an opportunity to actually generate alpha while everyone's trying to scramble the jets and figure out where to go?
It's a really interesting question that we talk about a lot. The question of whether this is a source of competitive advantage or something you need to do to keep up with the pack. How much of this is going to be driven by broad solutions from outside that raise everybody's game versus how you implement it is a constant point of conversation. I wouldn't say we've concluded on that yet, but that is very much part of the dialogue. It's also why we're trying to build it, what we're building, in a way that's flexible and we can take what we've learned and move it to whatever the right next step is. The other observation I'd make is that because these applications are different, it may be that there's lots of different models and lots of different engines out there that do these things differently. So we're keeping our eyes on all of that. What's interesting to me so far intellectually is, at least at this early stage, having people who understand how to do that backtesting on the business side and people who can translate that into the technology has been really helpful.
Is there a compliance angle to this as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first order of business was to make sure that we understood what information we were taking in to use and what information could leave the system and making sure nothing leaves the system that shouldn't. We have been at the forefront of cybersecurity and we are really cognizant of where our data is housed and where it goes. There's an aspect of that. And obviously there's an aspect of making sure that you understand where the information is coming from and making sure that that's all coming from the right sources. I think that'll be another area where you see a lot of the lawsuits out there about how these models learn. I don't know how that all plays out. One thing that's been really helpful for us, though, is having the model, the large language model, on premises and within our sandbox, so to speak, has been really helpful from both a customization perspective, but also from a security perspective. It makes us feel much better than pushing this thing into the ether.
You had mentioned earlier about a peer group. Is that something you would float across that close circle of people to just get their thoughts on where the puck's going?
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things about the industry and comparing it to other industries I've been in. It's obviously a fiercely competitive industry in a lot of ways, and you wouldn't expect anything different. It's also the most collaborative industry and some of the shared challenges, and you can call a peer and say, how do you deal with this internally? And there's an openness there for things that aren't viewed as necessarily part of competitive advantage or institutional secrets. There's a willingness to share opportunities, challenges, and have an open discussion that I haven't really seen in the other industries I've been in, which has been nice. There's a lot of shared issues, a lot of shared challenges. Sometimes it's just commiserating. Everyone's got some of the same growing pains, and then comparing notes is really helpful. So it's been interestingly the most competitive and also the most collegial industry I've worked in.
Terry, this has been really interesting and insightful. And I'd love to just close out with two questions. One is, what advice would you give to an emerging manager?
I think the two themes that have really helped me and I think helped the team think about the role of operations in an investment firm are we keeping investors investing and are we helping them be better investors? And there's lots of other things you need to do that don't fall in those categories. But by and large, when making decisions, if it's keeping investors investing and making them better investors, that's good. And if it's not, you should question why you're doing it. So it's been a really helpful yardstick as I've gone through. The other advice, and this is a little self-serving perhaps, given my varied background, but I do think looking outside for ideas, it is a co-opetition kind of industry. There is a collegiality out there, but it's also really helpful to see some of the patterns in other industries. And there's a lot of things that are very particular to public and private investing that don't translate, but there's a lot of things around how organizations work, how people behave, HR, IT, finance, that are really common from outside. And so I do think having some outside ideas coming in has been really helpful as well.
And then the other question I have is, what book or other industry resource do you commonly suggest to people?
I'm going to answer that two ways. One is, somewhat paradoxically, while you need to bring in the outside ideas, I do think the resource that's been really helpful to me in integrating into the industry and understanding how to be helpful to my firm is that peer group and that openness. And so getting ideas from them. So you want outside ideas, but there's also plenty of inside ideas that are helpful too. As general advice in my travels in these different industries and seeing how organizations work, the book I keep coming back to is a book called Please Understand Me, which is a relatively old Myers-Briggs-based book. Having the vocabulary to talk about how people process things, how they communicate, having that be a shared language within the firm. We talk about Enneagram a lot within the firm, but having that common vocabulary about the way people are interacting with each other has been so valuable in every job and every organization I've been involved in. I can't recommend that enough.
Terry, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you like what you heard, hop on our website at capitalallocators.com, where you can access past shows, join our mailing list, and sign up for premium content. Have a good one, and see you next time.